We must apologize for this late start. I made a mistake. I went to the doctor for my knee, and I had to wait for the doctor. I'm sorry for delaying. And my bag is locked up in my office, so I'm disorganized. We have decided to change the agenda slightly in order to accommodate PLUS. They will make the presentation. We do not want them to be part and parcel of our business. It may be too tedious for them. We have changed it slightly so that we can also have enough time to engage with the presentation that they will make. We note that some members are still late. They are not here. We had only four apologies for today, and one of the members that submitted an apology is here. And thanks to the whip, thank you very much, Chief, for changing your engagement. We have an apology of Honorable Delin and substitute member Honorable Balindlela, and Honorable Chabeleng is on a fact-finding mission to Kuha with another committee, and those are the ones that have submitted apologies, but the rest are supposed to be here. I'm told that Ngwenya Mabila is outside. She's supposed to be in here. She did that thing that I know from the Eastern Cape where people hang a jacket. She left a bag here. She's outside. The Honorable Nkosi Mandela has gone to watch the South Africa-Norway match in Europe, and he has permission to do so, and I will fight with the person who gave him permission later on, because nobody asked me for that. I only give permission to people to be absent if they fall ill, not for watching matches. If they're watching matches, I also send Africans and Alexandre Xalele Verg. Honourable members, if there is a matter on that should have been on this agenda, I open the space for that, or we proceed as it is.
Chair, I'm very sorry. A tough past three, I have to leave. I've got an appointment with the daughter in Bratuf.
But many people have got flu here, so we will keep you until 4. You say you're 4:15, so make an arrangement with the secretary to say the doctor must wait. I had waited for mine. Yours must wait for you. I see no hand of any member asking for an amendment in the agenda. I put the agenda to the meeting. Can we agree on it? Agreed? Mama Kaba. Mankaba, put on your microphone and speak.
Thank you, Chief.
Mankaba, light the bell. Lipa mwako.
Oh, thank you, Chairperson. I thought maybe you asked us to adopt the agenda. Yes, Chairperson, I adopting the agenda.
And there's no objection to us adopting the agenda as it stands. It was circulated in time. No objection. Thank you very much. Dr. Hall, I will give the opportunity for you to introduce your colleagues, but before we do that, because we missed you the last time, we invited you to our, yes, when I looked at your face, it didn't seem like acknowledging the fact that you missed the meeting last time. We have honorable members, but we're outnumbered by the people who work for the department and the parliament. We have a new member that has joined our committee, adding to the number of ANC members to this committee. And thanks to the chief whip of the rule of majority party. Ma'am, your name.
Okay, I'm Noma Tema November from the Northern Cape in Appingville.
Thank you very much. I'm sure you know this young man here. He's very helpful to the committee. All members of the committee know this young man. Pumla Nyanzwa is the secretary of... What my surname being written wrong and spelled wrong every day, so don't object to that. My name is Stone Susan. I'm a chairperson of the committee.
Okay, I'm Helen Matanyani. I'm the whip for this committee.
Pane, member of this committee.
Also the chief whip of the UDM.
Mvume Dandala, member of this committee for COPE.
And also the parliamentary leader of COPE.
I'm Thembi Sakavetele, I'm the researcher for the committee.
I'm Pretty Baba Mamkize from the ANC, from Gauteng province.
Mamkize, I'm not just from Gauteng, I'm from KZN, so Mosh. Quickly.
I'm Mrs. Benefit Kwele, an interpreter for isiZulu, having come to serve Mrs. Baba Mamkize.
Thank you very much. The gentleman on the other side. Chief.
Blessing Bara, I'm from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
I'm Khais Musi from African National Congress, an alternate member in this committee. Thank you.
I'm a member of the committee from the
DA.
Boyne Fadi from the DA, member of this committee. Thank you.
You must not omit to say that you are a shadow minister. Okay, thank you very much.
My name is Karen Kemwe, and I'm a research at life.
My name is Ruth Hall. I'm a researcher at life.
Chairperson, or can I, is it okay if I also introduce myself, sir? Thank you so much, sir.
My name is Obioso Ustadi. I'm a policy dialogue officer at life.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Chief.
Yeah, okay. The name is Mukasa Pascal Musia, and I'm the chairperson for Kaya Lagunya, Human Development. Kaya Lagunya is the abbreviation for Kaya Licha, Langa, Guguletu, and Nyanga, and we deal with education, social development, but we have 13 divisions and 23 subunits. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much, Chief. That's very important to know.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Hall. Opportunity is given over to you.
Yeah. Good afternoon, all. My name is Jaya Chetty. I'm the parliamentary officer in the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform.
Good afternoon. I'm Zola Rueni, the parliamentary officer in the Office of the Minister.
Good afternoon. I'm Snow Goba, Communications Minister.
If I may. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm delighted to be here, Ruth Hall, Plas, University of the Western Cape. I see already that you have a very strict chairperson, so I will try to stick to time. We are delighted to be here. Plas, as you may know, is the Institute for Poverty, Land, and Agrarian Studies. We are not for poverty, we are for studying poverty, land, and agrarian issues. And, of course, our name PLAS indicates what it is that we're looking at, which is issues around land, farms, and the rights of rural people. PLAS, for many years, has been supportive of the process of land reform. We are also a critical voice. We do independent research, and we aim to be a constructive, informed voice that can assist government, civil society, and the public at large to engage in this absolutely critical issue of land reform in South Africa. I'm here with colleagues, who I will introduce in a moment, just to say something about PLAS. PLAS engages in research, in training, in policy development and advocacy in relation to a number of areas. We're known mostly for our work around land reform, but our work is wider than that. We work on rural and urban poverty and inequality, land and agrarian reform, agricultural and non-agricultural livelihoods in rural areas, fisheries and coastal communities' livelihoods, issues around water, forests, rangelands, and particularly rural communities' rights to these important resources. And we work on the dynamics of chronic poverty. In other words, how is it that poor people stay poor, and how do they cope? Survive. I mustn't. That wasn't intentional. And issues of rural people's vulnerability and the intergenerational transmission of poverty. These are some broad issues that we work on, and I'd like to give a moment for just one sentence each of my colleagues to say what they work on and how they fit into the organization.
Thank you, Ruth. I'll just say very briefly, as a policy dialogue officer, I am working on different ways to ensure that the research that we do at PLAS also affects change in society. So we organize public discussions, we engage with government, with people in civil society organizations. Something like this with parliament is also a very important part of policy engagement, trying to inform the debate and also getting policies to actually work and also to be informed by research. Thank you.
And my colleague, Karen Chainboy.
Thank you, Ruth. Currently, I'm facilitating a Southern African regional program entitled Land Reform from Below, Decentralized Land Reform in Southern Africa. And it's a platform for dialogue between countries, which involves scholars, academics, practitioners, and policymakers to really try and learn from the lessons from the different countries in Southern Africa. And we distribute an annual review of what is happening with land issues around the region. We also develop policy briefs, and we bring together practitioners and people involved in land reform across the region together in an annual regional workshop. I'm also editing a newsletter called Mhlaba Wethu, which is really tracking and monitoring land reform in South Africa and analyzing it in such a way that it is accessible for both policymakers and practitioners as well as civil society. Thank you.
So, I just wanted to introduce the people here. We're not just here for decoration. Colleagues and members, thank you again for this opportunity. I was asked to give an introduction to a book that we have produced as PLAS, It is not the kind of book that is only for an academic audience. It's a book entitled Another Countryside? Policy Options for Land and Agrarian Reform in South Africa. And you may know that the World Social Forum says another world is possible. That is their slogan. So we're asking a question. In South Africa, is another countryside possible? Are we always going to have two different kinds of countrysides, the wealthy commercial farming areas with their history of past state subsidies and their good infrastructure, and communal areas, which are areas of poverty and overcrowding? So the question is how land reform, as part of a wider process of agrarian reform, can contribute to creating, really, another countryside. The background to the production of this book was in the early days of the land reform program. Already by the end of the 1990s, it became clear that there were serious problems with progress in terms of the amount of land being redistributed. But in addition to that, it already became evident that where people had got access to land, they encountered enormous problems in using that land effectively to produce and to improve their livelihoods. So the concerns went far beyond the question of how to get the land, but also the question of how to use it. At this time, the former minister, Toko Didiza, introduced a new policy framework, LRAD, the Land Redistribution for Agricultural Development, which came online from 2001, which shifted the emphasis from the previous program. There had been real problems in the early phase, but it had focused specifically on land for the poor. And this shift introduced by the minister aimed to answer the problems of poor people having land but no money to invest in it by actually shifting the focus to including among land reform beneficiaries a greater proportion of better off people who had their own resources to invest. And this caused quite a response from the NGO sector, who argued that the answer to the problems encountered is not to shift to those who have better resources, but for the state to play a more proactive role in ensuring that pro-poor land reform can work. So Plaas was asked to actually explore this issue and to look into what are the practices of land reform, what research and information do we have available about the process, what are some possible alternatives, and what would be their implications. And this book is the product of that process. I'm going to come to some key messages in a moment. I want to frame for you some of the foundational questions that we posed and that we attempted to answer in this book. The book doesn't provide a blueprint of alternatives. It provides a number of ideas and perspectives that we hope will be useful. Three key questions are, what are we doing land reform for? It's a political project, but what is the ultimate vision and intended outcome of land reform? What kind of land uses, production, and livelihoods are we trying to produce? Secondly, land reform how and for whom? What kind of land demand is there out there? Who is wanting land for what? How should the program be targeted? And how should land be acquired? And you will remember that in 2005 we had a national land summit where a new acknowledgement came from government that in fact a willing buyer, willing seller approach is a key problem. That is a problem of acquisition. But we still don't know exactly what the alternative is to willing buyer, willing seller. But we also are emphasizing that acquisition is only one part of a bigger set of challenges. A third foundational question is, if we're doing land reform, with what kind of land rights? What land rights should people be having? Is this all private ownership? We have group-based projects that come with a number of complexities. So what kinds of tenure arrangements and support are needed to enable effective land administration so that people who have land have secure rights to it? I just want to indicate that we had a number of methods involved in this project, secondary and primary research on a number of areas, including livelihood impacts, regional sectoral studies, national and commodity sector data, and we looked at a lot of case study research. We also engaged in some original case study research looking at projects, looking at commodity sectors and regions. We tried to develop a typology of the different kinds of project designs that we see in land reform. We had a number of roundtable debates with civil society and government together looking at land acquisition. One was called Land Acquisition Beyond Willing Buyer, Willing Seller. Another roundtable on farm worker equity schemes. Do they really bring about change in the lives of farm workers? One around agrarian systems, restructuring the rural economy. And finally, one on political parameters for land and agrarian reform. We also held an ambitious program of holding workshops with rural people, rural communities around the country, to engage around people's visions for land and agrarian reform in areas where they live. and we co-hosted these with NGOs and a range of people from restitution claimants, commonage users, people living on Transnet and forestry land, people who are labor tenants, LRAD beneficiaries and others attended, as well as many traditional leaders, land affairs officials, mayors, ANC constituency office staff, and church leaders and others. All of this culminated in a major conference, which a number of former members of this committee attended with the same name of book. And so I want to just run through these three themes and to share with you a few of the insights. It's not really possible to summarize it all, but I want to raise a few key insights with you. On the theme of land reform for what? I'm going to start with some conclusions, which is a conclusion that land reform ultimately is a political project that still needs to clarify its precise economic rationale. Overall, land reform has been driven by the target of reaching 30%, which in some senses has become a holy grail. That 30% was a policy target that was quite arbitrary in its origin. But clearly we need to understand of what do we intend to achieve if we were to achieve this 30% target. How different would the rural areas be? And the striking conclusion that we arrive at is that existing policy doesn't have a specific view on a number of key questions. It's agnostic, effectively, on questions like where should redistribution take place? Who is to benefit? What types of land should be prioritized for redistribution? What kind of production should take place? And how should the wider policy and economic environment change in order to support new types of production? And how should this bring about change in the rural economy? So you can see that the focus moves from looking at land reform narrowly to agrarian reform to rural development. So a key conclusion of the book is that land reform is happening in the absence of an agrarian reform that can actually help people to use land rights to their own benefit. If we look at types of projects, I said we try to develop a typology, and very broadly what we find is that in the top left-hand corner, group ownership and group use is the dominant model. So although this model features nowhere in policy, in practice, most land reform projects involve groups of people holding land together. There have been some attempts to limit group size under the LRAD program, but effectively we have whole farms under collective enterprises, usually trying to replicate the existing commercial uses that the previous owners were engaged with. And usually in project planning, there's no opportunity for members of those groups to use the land for anything other than the commercial use for which it was designated. Much less common, on the bottom left, is a model of groups owning land but actually using it individually. And actually this is much more similar to what we see in communal areas where people might have some collective land but produce separately. This is also a model that emerges often by default where there's some big commercial project plan but it fails to materialize or there's conflict and it collapsed and there's effectively sort of self-help by members marking out plots for their own production. So one of the results of this model is that often local authorities cannot come in with infrastructure and services because people are engaged in unplanned land uses, and that seems to be quite a common model, even though it's often as a result of unplanned processes. Much less common is, in fact, the vision that was enshrined in policy, which is that we are creating smallholders, small family farms. So on the right-hand side, individual ownership and use of land is much less common. Usually these are family enterprises where every member is registered as a beneficiary. And this is a model that has been promoted through LRAD. But in practice, it's only available to the better off because it means that you need to buy a whole farm with very little grant money because you only have a few family members. So in practice, this option of family farms has not been available to most poor communities. It's been more available to those people who have their own capital or who can get loan finance. And a fourth model of project that we need to think about is joint ventures. And this model is becoming much more prevalent. Included under this category are contract farming, sharecropping, equity schemes, and strategic partnerships. And these have been promoted particularly as the dominant model in which restitution, the big community restitution claims are being settled, partly as a result of fears that if the claims are settled and the communities return to their land, that production will decline rapidly. So the focus of joint ventures is normally on maintaining production, and the aim is not to change land use. But for many beneficiaries who don't return to their land, but simply become shareholders of these enterprises, the flow of benefits is extremely uncertain in terms of when they're going to get dividends, whether they will get future employment on these farms, where, of course, other people are already employed, and whether there are any other benefits that might arise for them. So that's sort of an outline of the types of projects. What we did is we looked at what are some of the outcomes and impacts. It's extremely hard to give a very accurate national picture of the outcomes and impacts in terms of livelihoods for the beneficiaries of land reform. What we do know is that the quality of life survey, probably the most comprehensive to date, shows widespread underutilization of land across all project types and across provinces. We know that by the time the second survey was done, 38% of beneficiaries were deriving some kind of income from the sale of produce. Many were not. And there was also enormous unevenness and inequality across households within the same project. One of the most thorough provincial studies actually was in the Northwest, and I think this is the kind of study that needs to be replicated elsewhere in the country. A third of the projects in this province were identified as being locked in intractable conflict. Over half had no implements for production. 65% were not following their business plans. A very interesting finding from the Northwest study was that there is an inverse correlation between success and adherence to plans. So a lot of these project plans were very ambitious. And in fact, where people chose to make another plan and go off and do something, even in the absence of support, they actually did better than those who tried to stick to a business plan that emphasized commercial production only. So people were often diversifying, and often the results were better where they did so. A third important source of information is a study by the Community Agency for Social Inquiry looking at 128 projects. This was of restitution only, which found that 83% hadn't achieved their agricultural aims and that only one of these projects was generating sustainable profits. Of course, we have to look at these with a pinch of salt because there isn't actually absolutely clarity on what constitutes success in land reform, and there are different indicators of success. I think that is something to acknowledge. But I think it's also important to emphasize that there is nationally a lack of baseline data, and I think it is an issue to raise with the department. We don't have baseline data, and so and we also don't have stable samples across these surveys, and that makes it very difficult to have clear impact assessment to say what is the impact of land reform. In the long term, having clear impact assessment will be a precondition for increased allocations from Treasury, which wants to know about the effectiveness of the public funds being put into land reform. But I think that overall these studies do confirm the widespread problems of inappropriate planning that emphasize only commercial farming and only a single enterprise per farm, rather than diversification of livelihoods, which is a common strategy for poor households. And they also confirm a lack of support for production experienced by most projects. So in practice, the challenges that we face around land use and livelihoods in land reform shows that redistribution has, in particular, has privileged commercial farming as a model and has forced often large groups of poor people to take over entire farms and try to operate these collectively with very limited capital. This is a deeply problematic and complex model, and interestingly, it doesn't feature in policy itself. It's a model that has emerged in practice over time, and it's also the product of three primary factors that are shaping practices in land reform. And one is the reliance on the purchase of whole properties offered for sale. So we wait until farmers are offering whole farms, and then we're buying whole farms. Secondly, the small size of grants compared to the price of land, so people are having to pool their grants. And thirdly, the failure to subdivide land. So we're seeing a lot of continuity in land reform, trying to ensure that land continues to be operated in the same way. There's been some attempt to shift the focus to those who have more resources or to try and resolve these problems through establishing joint ventures. But these requirements to demonstrate commercial viability are somewhat at odds with the fact that the commercial farming sector itself has been going through something of a crisis and has been restructuring over the past 10 years or so. And I think a key message from the book is that this model of commercial farming, of whole farm units, heavy levels of mechanization and so on, is actually at odds with key trends in the agricultural sector. So we have an agricultural policy process that is ongoing, that is creating a deeply hostile environment for new entrants being established through land reform. And this contradiction cannot be resolved by practitioners on the ground. It is actually a contradiction that lies at a policy level and requires a policy response. On the second theme of land reform, how and for whom, we looked at critically the issue of the willing buyer, willing seller principle. We know the key features of this approach, which was also the approach adopted in the 1980s in Zimbabwe. It was the model that was advocated by the World Bank to the ANC in early discussions before 1994. And it has framed our policy up to now. The key features of this model are non-interference with land markets and the unwillingness of the state to expropriate land for land reform purposes, even though it is empowered to do so in terms of Section 25, 2 and 3 of the Constitution. So it's a choice not to use those powers. Thirdly, reliance on landowners to make land available for sale. Fourthly, self-selection by beneficiaries, so waiting for people to come and self-identify. And fifthly, the purchase of land at market price. None of these are legal requirements. These are policy choices. And as I've said, these two factors of the grant structure and reliance on land being offered for sale have led to a widely recognized mismatch between applicants' needs and available land. So we kept on finding situations where groups of people had been trying for some years to get land as a group and had identified the areas where they wanted land, often close to where they're living now, but instead were offered, no, you must buy a large commercial farm 100 kilometers away because that's the one available for sale. So yes, there's a lot of land being offered in the land market, and yes, there are people wanting land, but those don't match. And unless the state is engaged with people to create opportunities to make available land to meet real needs, we are going to continually be sending people off to resettlement sites that don't meet their needs and that are often far away from the resources and infrastructure that they need. And this mismatch, I think, has been aggravated by the failure to facilitate subdivision of farms into portions better suited to beneficiary needs. Some of the outcomes of this willing buyer, willing seller approach, of course, for some people it means that they simply cannot access land. But where redistribution happens, it tends to be ad hoc and patchy. So there's a project over there, there's a project over there. In terms of facilitating services by local government, this makes it incredibly difficult. We have a mosaic approach. It also means that it's very planning intensive, enormously burdensome for the departments involved, who have to do one-by-one planning rather than looking at an area, a group of people with similar needs, and planning at a wider, larger scale. It also results in isolation and an absence of solidarity among land reform beneficiaries who are isolated in these different areas. And what is missing from all of this is a serious effort to match the provision of land to real and identified needs. So we know there's need, we know there's opportunity. The idea that supply and demand will magically find each other is sort of a neoclassical economics myth that in these cases is simply not being borne out. Recently, well, from 2006, the Department of Land Affairs, as it was then, adopted the Proactive Land Acquisition Strategy, PLAS, which is not to be confused with the name of our organization, PLAS. PLAS. So the Proactive Acquisition Strategy effectively empowered officials to go out and buy land on the market. So the state has entered the market now as a market player, not just an intermediary, but as effectively a willing buyer in the willing buyer, willing seller. It's not an alternative to willing buyer, willing seller. It just means that the state is the buyer. But what we have found in our research, and we've done some case studies looking at how this has been used, we find that government has been a poorly informed player in the market because officials have no clear basis on which to determine which land to buy, for whom, why, and for what purposes. So a fairly uncritical buyer-up of land. We looked, for instance, in Gertsibande district in Mpumalanga, where we found that a large number of farms had been bought all of them. I think there were 18 farms have been bought from two owners. So effectively it looked like farmers who were in trouble who wanted to exit the sector were able to find a ready buyer in the state, and quite an uncritical buyer in the state. It was unclear whether those were the right farms to be buying for the people who had needs right there. So we need to shift away from that that idea that just if we can get more land, it's going to solve the problem. Government needs to be a much more informed and strategic engager in the land market. Area-based planning is one innovation that has been brought in also in the past few years, effectively starting from 2007, and it's an approach that looks at a district level and at local municipality level, trying to identify what land is needed and therefore have a local land reform plan. This potentially can provide guidance, and it's a positive development. I think it's worth asking the department exactly where is that process at. Much of it was outsourced to consultants. Many people complained that the consultants weren't consulting with them. And it's not been reported on very widely where that process has got up to. But most importantly, I think the proactive land acquisition strategy has been a mechanism to scale up acquisition, to try and speed up delivery while avoiding the problems of the grant system. So because people couldn't actually afford to buy land with the small grants available from government, the proactive strategy allowed government to buy up the land without being constrained by having to go through a grant system. But this raises serious questions about governance and accountability. On what basis are beneficiaries now being chosen and allocated land, and on what terms? How much land are people getting? And it also, of course, that raises a question about equity, about how resources are being rationed. In the past, a notion of fairness and equity was being promoted by having standard grant levels. Now you will find, if you look in the last few years' annual reports, that much of the land in many of the provinces that is reported as being transferred has been actually acquired, but if you look under the beneficiary column, it's zero beneficiaries. So hundreds of thousands of hectares bought by government, acquired by government, but not yet redistributed to anyone. So on the one hand, we have a state land disposal process that I'm sure you're aware of. On the other hand, the state is acquiring land with the intention of further redistributing it. There's very little public oversight over that process of what is happening with this land that has been bought. Was it the right land? How are beneficiaries being allocated? And are people being given standard amounts of land? Or are some people getting very large amounts of land and others very little? I think that that is a real unknown area. This is just an example. An elderly couple in Mpumalanga, they're actually labor tenants who had a pending labor tenant application and then found that government had, through the proactive strategy, bought up a number of farms in the area and was now telling all the other labor tenants to come and move on to this farm. So they were being told that this is how their application was being settled, and that they would now need to share the land with a number of other communities. It's just an example of what is happening under the proactive strategy, which, as I say, is one response to the problems of willing buyer, willing seller, but doesn't necessarily resolve all the problems. The process that we went through really looked at how to move beyond willing buyer, willing seller and the market-based approach, but also not to use this uninformed supply-led approach of the proactive strategy. And the alternative, we feel, is something like a proactive needs-based approach that is people-driven, that takes needs as the starting point, but also state-supported, and something that uses the market, but also overrides it where needed. I think that ideologically, we tend to get very polarized around this issue of state and market. The market-based program is incredibly limited, but it has also been very state-mediated. It's been very bureaucratic, and yet there are even opportunities on the market that we've not used. So what we're encouraging is the strategic use of market opportunities, but also if you have strongly identified needs, it is possible to override the market on a good basis. You know why you are going to now acquire land, whether through expropriation or some other means, to meet real and identified needs. So we have tried to, in the book, describe this alternative that was discussed at length through our consultative processes. The idea is that participants initiate projects, but also are assisted to identify their needs. Acquisition is determined by planned priorities. Land sizes must be adjusted to meet needs, including through subdivision. there's a possibility of a spatially coherent approach of buying land in bulk, planning and allocating at scale, and the possibility of direct transfer or indirect transfer via state agencies, and the provision of appropriate infrastructure. And in the book, there is an outline of willing buyer, willing seller, contrasted with a proactive needs-based approach as one contribution to thinking through these alternatives. The third theme looked at what kind of land rights in land reform, and the two themes here. One is tenure rights for people living on commercial farms, and the other is rights of people in land reform projects. On the first issue, often a neglected issue, the 3 million farm workers and farm dwellers who live in South Africa, whose rights are enshrined in law under these two laws, Land Reform Labour Tenants Act and ESTA, the Extension of Security of Tenure Act. We know that just under 1 million people were evicted from farms in the first 10 years of democracy. This means that the rate of evictions in that first 10 years was greater than the rate of evictions from 84 to 93. It's also faster than the rate at which we've been giving people access to land through land reform. So this is a very far-reaching issue. It means that more black South Africans have been losing homes and access to land than gaining it in the new South Africa. Of course, they're different people often. So there is a class dimension to this, that certain people are being displaced from land, others are getting access to land. But this issue of securing rights is really a critical thing. Land reform is not just about redistributing private ownership. It's about changing the relations, class relations, between people who are owners and people who are long-term tenants and who have rights to land and to tenure security. And I'm afraid that there is no other way to say it, and there are some details in the book and in many other sources that ESTA has been an abject failure. Formal ownership prevails when it comes to disputes between different rights holders. And the vast majority of evictions have not involved a court order as required by law. So, in fact, only 1% of the evictions noted in the survey actually went to court. So if we look at what's happening in the courts, we are missing the story of evictions. And I know you're going to be discussing the Land Rights Management Facility. Really, what goes to court is the tip of the iceberg. The question is, what else is happening out there? And why do local authorities, police, other agencies, provincial offices of the department, how are we not sharing information about all these other disputes that escalate and lead to evictions? We also know that most of those who go to court don't have legal representation, and of course that is an ongoing issue. A final issue around tenure rights on farms is that Section 4 of ESTA is really far-reaching. ESTA is not meant to be about regulating evictions. It's actually meant to be about securing rights on farms and enabling people who are living on farms to upgrade their tenure rights so that they can have long-term tenure security, including the option of ownership, either of a portion of land where they are living now or off-farm. This Section 4 has been almost entirely unimplemented. Nationally, there have been less than 50 projects, as reported by the department last time. So effectively, the developmental vision of ESTA has been, it appears, abandoned. Instead, people who are going to be evicted are invited to apply for the redistribution process. So I think that there are questions to ask about what is really the vision for the future of farm dwellers and the vision for how to give effect to ESTA. A second area around the question of tenure rights, what kind of rights, is the question of the rights of people who are part of group projects. Now, land reform is constantly about creating groups. Virtually all land transferred to groups is registered in freehold title in the name of a legal entity like a communal property association or a trust. So the beneficiaries are not actually the owners. They are members of a legal entity, and they have procedural rights. If you're a member of a CPA, you can attend meetings, you can vote, you can stand for a position on a committee. So the allocation of substantive rights to use land depends on the robustness of these institutions, these community structures. But most groups, we find, are ill-prepared for the task of land administration, and there are large numbers of weak and dysfunctional CPAs that are often incapable of ensuring fair access to land by their members, and importantly, have very weak capacity to exclude outsiders. And this is a key issue because often you have rival institutions, say a CPA committee, but also a chief or somebody else, allocating land and extracting rents for allocations. So the question of mechanisms for entry and exit and supporting these institutions to take on land administration tasks is crucial. We also note that the department and the minister have not complied with their obligations set out in the CPA Act of 1996, which includes to maintain a register of CPAs, to receive reports from them, and to report to Parliament. Fundamental questions then remain about the state's role in land administration in these publicly funded resettlement schemes, and there's clearly a need to revisit the policy framework for group resettlement. I think that we have, because private ownership has been so well supported by the state in South Africa with our deeds registry and cadastral system, we assume that private ownership is going to secure people's rights. But when you have large groups of poor people and there's contestation around rights, you actually need a public function. You need a public state role in supporting land administration. The CPA Act envisaged CPAs as quasi-public-private entities. The state still has a responsibility to support them. I think, Chairperson, we're running towards the end of time. Can I have 5 minutes? Thank you. Very briefly, two other chapters I want to mention that appear in the book. One looks at the dynamics of commercial farming, and the other looks at scenarios for the future. The one on commercial farming notes the very rapid deregulation we've had in agriculture, the dismantling of the marketing boards, the end of heavily subsidized credit and bailouts for indebted farmers, rapid liberalization of trade, all of this through the late 90s, through the late 80s, through the early 90s, so that by the end of the 1990s, South Africa had the lowest level of public support, the public support estimate in the world of all countries that keep estimates. So we've gone from being a highly protected and subsidized agricultural sector to a very open and competitive and unsupported one. Outcomes are that employment is declining rapidly. Many people lost jobs. Exports are rising, though, but it's a very volatile and insecure setting for producers. And we've seen, as a result of this, enormous consolidation of ownership of land and capital in the agricultural sector. These are processes that are totally at odds with land reform. Yeah? We have fewer and fewer commercial farming units in South Africa. We've fallen down from 60 to 45,000 in just 4 years. So fewer owners of land, fewer owners of capital. There's also a degree that is unknown of underutilization of land. So there are growing disparities in agriculture, in the commercial sector. There are winners and losers. Just to give you a sense, most commercial farming units have very low turnover, below 300,000 a year. A small proportion have very high turnovers. And in fact, if we were to continue that line further to the right, you'd see that there are just 8 agribusinesses that have turnover above R1 billion a year. So this is a highly differentiated and unequal sector in itself. I think there's a strategic question of where along the spectrum should restructuring focus. Do we want to restructure and engage in transformation at the top end of where the agribusinesses dominate, or at the bottom end where smaller white farmers have low turnover and are often in debt, employ fewer workers per farm, but that's also where most farm workers are employed. There are strategic questions. So commercial farming is shedding jobs, it's supporting fewer livelihoods, and it's an incredibly hostile environment for new entrants. So then we thought, well, let's look at scenarios for the future of employment and self-employment in agriculture, because really this is the question of what land and agrarian reform will produce. Looked at a number of scenarios. I'm not going to go through them. One of a failed redistributive land reform, one of the intensification of commercial agriculture, one that looks at a successful large-scale redistributive land reform while also maintaining a core of competitive commercial farms, one which looks at simply deracializing commercial agriculture. So you take a number of farms. You can take 30% of the farms and replace a white owner with a black owner. A fifth option is public estate farming, so large industrialized state-owned farms. That's one version of agrarian reform. And another, which is large-scale redistribution, but a populist redistribution that results in production decline. So we looked at what would be the outcomes of each of these different scenarios based on existing trends, broad estimations, and a bunch of agricultural economists have done this work and looked at the implications of each of these scenarios for either the growth or decline of employment among agricultural workers, large-scale black farmers, black smallholders, semi-subsistence producers, and also workers, employees of smallholders, and looked at, you know, we are comparing different strategies for the future, who might win or lose out. And the scenario work, basically, I think the big message was that it drew attention to the importance of food production as a part-time activity for poor rural households. Presently, about 4.5 million semi-subsistence producers are operating in South Africa. These are largely part-time producers in former communal areas, largely, who are producing food as part of their livelihood strategies. Not full-time, not for the market. Two-thirds of these are women. So the majority of agricultural producers in South Africa are working at a very small scale. These are often the poorest people. Many of them are women. Our agricultural policy has tended to ignore them. Some of the findings of the scenario work is it is true that land reform can have negative consequences for employment on commercial farms, but this impact can be limited by targeting unutilized land or underutilized land and also creating opportunities for farm workers, for employees, to become producers in their own right or to combine employment with their own production. A second finding is that really the number of semi-subsistence producers is very large relative to other categories, and we expect it to grow anyway. Increasingly, we have this category of people in communal areas who are producing on a micro scale, who are often not recognized as farmers, in addition to whom there are in the region of 200,000 smallholder producers. So one conclusion is any efforts to use agriculture as a means to create livelihoods should include former homelands as a central component. This is not happening. So to the extent that we have reintroduced support measures for agriculture through CASP and other measures, the vast bulk of the available resources to support agriculture have been directed towards land reform projects and so have missed out on this very large population of disadvantaged black producers in communal areas. So this is an issue to address. I know that many of these issues are not within the control of this committee or this department, but I think they are very relevant for the future of agrarian reform and of rural development. And finally, I think an important finding is there is plenty of opportunity to cater for different categories of beneficiary. The current focus on black commercial farmers, though, should be moderated to create more livelihoods. It is possible to create very substantial increases in the number of black commercial farmers, even within a program that has as its focus smallholder production. Because we're moving from a very low base, there are very few black commercial farmers. It's possible to have very dramatic increases there, while within a program that aims to maximize the number of livelihoods created through agrarian reform. I think that I will have to leave this out. I wanted to talk about some of the messages coming from our workshops with rural people and the particular preferences that they raised, and also international experience. And I'd like to just set out quite schematically the kinds of paradigm choices that we set out in the book, the choices for policy and for policymakers. And the one is to continue with a market-based approach, or gearing up with the private sector, or a developmental state model where the state comes in, or a radical restructuring model. And within each of these, we looked at some of the possible measures that could be adopted by policy and what some of the possible outcomes could be. In the first market-based approach, we see a focus on commercial production, reliance on the market to provide support to beneficiaries, so they must buy services on the open market. No particular change in the current state role and a continuation of current trends. Our view was that this is essentially politically untenable to continue on this path, given what we already know about the many challenges facing land reform. A second paradigm is gearing up with the private sector, which would see perhaps improved resources from the state, but more reliance on the private sector as the implementer. And I think that there are already trends towards this direction from the department of getting the private sector to be an accredited implementer for the private sector to make up for, in a sense, some of the weaknesses of the department itself. This would involve very limited restructuring of markets and effectively limited deracialization, which is the priority of the private sector to deracialize its own structures. A third option is the developmental state, which could see interventions in land markets, also in input and credit and output markets, production subsidies, extension and infrastructure, and a focus on growing the smallholder sector while also retaining a core of commercial agriculture. Of course, some people are calling for radical restructuring and for not maintaining the commercial sector and not maintaining private property rights. So radical restructuring could be an option, involving legal and economic measures to counter the dominance of agribusiness, nationalization and or large-scale expropriation, and one of two directions, either a sort of a peasantry movement towards smallholders or state control of estate farming. Now, our view is that, and in debate with many actors in the sector, that the current market-based approach is untenable. It's a source of anger for rural people and a poor investment currency. Radical restructuring also seems unfeasible. There's very little mobilization from below that would push towards anything like nationalization. So really we're left with two options, which is gearing up with the private sector and the developmental state. Our view is that the vision of the agricultural industry is for deracialization, and this is what we see in the strategic plan for agriculture, for instance, or in Agri-BEE. At the same time, the ANC has embraced the idea of a developmental state to invest directly in the second economy and to be a catalyst to pro-poor growth and structural change in the dual economy. So it's possible that elements of the latter two, of gearing up with the private sector and the developmental state, may be compatible. It may be possible for the state to engage in a more progressive, pro-poor land and agrarian reform process while also partnering with the private sector to play a stronger role in deracializing the commercial sector. It is possible that these could coexist. I think more thought needs to happen be put into how that would happen. And finally, we developed through the process and on the basis of much consultation some of the elements of an agrarian reform, a land and agrarian reform that would go beyond transferring land and would support pro-poor land reform and production by the poor and prioritize smallholders. This would include a number of dimensions. We have identified six. Firstly, change the size distribution of land holdings. You cannot have rural land and agrarian reform unless you are willing to break up large commercial farms, create new boundaries, and to do so creatively in ways that are locally appropriate. So this would need to include a range of different size units. We need to be moving towards a more of a mixed farming sector. Secondly, support production for consumption as well as for sale. This has been a blind spot in land reform, looking at how people can be supported to produce food for themselves, not only for market purposes, and to promote low-risk, low-input production technologies, change the use of labor by promoting self-employment and encouraging labor-intensive production, build links into value-adding. In a sense, this is also an agenda for the rural development process to move beyond just the farm area to look at what's happening in the local economy. Build links into value-adding for small producers by prioritizing cooperatives in agro-processing and create incentives and regulation of the food processing industry to force them to source from small farmers. There are enormous barriers for small farmers to get access into these downstream activities by value adders and processing companies. Fifthly, invest in non-farm economic activities to provide inputs and investments into part-time farming and change settlement patterns. All of this requires changing settlement patterns to allow a more dispersed settlement pattern on the urban fringe and also where land is redistributed, allowing people to establish settlements that can be serviced and gain access to the support of local government. So, key messages. Agricultural policies mitigate against success in land reform. They need to change if land and agrarian reform is to succeed. Secondly, land reform can't succeed in isolation, and we keep making the same mistakes. Thirdly, there is a need for agrarian policy to specify what kind of restructuring is needed that can satisfy the political demand for land reform and also address society's interest in reducing poverty and inequality. Fourth, the neglected option of smallholder production for consumption and for the market, both, should be the priority for state policy, though not to the exclusion of other models, including black commercial farmers. Fifthly, to enable success, direct production support as well as interventions in input processing and output markets are needed, and this will require a developmental state with a clear policy vision. So I hope that you can hear that there is a strong call for clearer vision, for big choices at a high level. I understand that now this portfolio committee is not addressing agriculture, and I suppose you are having discussions with your counterparts, so I hope that this is of use. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hall. Honorable members, this is the opportunity to raise the issues you want to raise so that we can engage with the presenter. The book is available in the market. What's wrong? I am waiting for, excuse me, ma'am, Pumla will do that. Yours is to engage with the debate. I have noted people have raised hands. Macaba.
Thank you, Shepherdson. My question just is one. I would like to know whether there is a no way to educate people in rural area who do not want to work cooperatively so that they understand that it is easy to, it is for them to get however, whatever kind of assistance, if they work together, it is my view that people in rural areas should be educated about this. If I feel that we as the committee should go to them and empower them and make them understand the importance and the advantages of working on land together. Please, committee, understand me. I did not understand correctly English because I'm not educated as well. And I'm trying to cover all the people who are here because there is a white people here. They did not understand my language because I'm talking the Zulu. Thanks, Chairperson.
Asina language singayithethiyo. Ungakhathazeki wena, inanto kwenza nokuthi imfundo yomuntu ingakanani. Inento kwenza nokuthi ufuna uthini. Abe parliament thina sizothetha. Honorable Stein.
Thank you, Chin. Firstly, I just want to say thank you for the presentation. I don't know if you know, but yesterday we've also launched a bit of a research that the two of us was doing. It's not nearly as extensive as yours, just the two of us went into farms trying to find out what is actually happening. And what you're saying here today is exactly what we found. My discussion would really be based onto this committee is that it's all good and well now, but what are we going to do about this? Because there are real problems and needs, and it is basically more based on policy. You know, we also found that what happened is had all kinds of consequences, like the big groups that's not working together, and all of that is making it difficult for the people to survive out there. In certain instances, we actually found people where they came on the farm with, say, for instance, 50 cattle. Now they sit with 10, but they think they're making a success. They're going backwards in most cases, and it is really a huge problem. I think my question is more based to the chair. So we need to do something, and to wait until 3 years or 4 years, it's too long. I think by that time, most of the farms would have been felled that were redistributed or given back to people. Thank you.
Thank you for a very enlightening summary, Dr. Hall. I'm really looking forward to immersing myself in this book. I am interested, though, I don't know whether you've done this in the book or not. Have you compared our situation to other similar situations of land reform, particularly in developing countries? And do you have a model of success that you could say to us, for instance, when you raise the criticisms, you could do the comparisons and actually say, we're failing here, but that country succeeded here on this basis and so on. I don't know if I've made myself clear.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I also like to thank the presenter for having done a very good presentation to us. And I just want to find out with regard to this, the policy choices that you have just mentioned. You indicated four of them, and I don't know whether is it possible, maybe, if you can come up with a model that is going to actually incorporate this policy, so that maybe we can get something, because it seems in most areas, especially from the from our black brothers and sisters who are actually staying in a very poor conditions, those who actually want to have these farms, if they could be helped, because really outside the people, they don't have the right direction. They don't know what to do, in fact. So they are so very much confused. So I just want to find out, is it possible maybe to incorporate all this so that we can come up with something that's going to be working out there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by thanking the presenter. I think it was an informative presentation. But I've got a few questions to ask. Number one, on the issue of this CAP, I don't know whether, is there any research that you have, a little bit of research that you have done on the impact of CAP, especially to small-scale producers or farmers. Then somewhere in your slide, you indicated under the dynamics whereby you indicated the un- and under-utilization of the land. But continuing with that sentence, you indicated 91% arable land is fully utilized. Maybe if I can get the clarity on that one. Then, when doing the research, you indicated, you commented on the implementation of ESTA. On your research, were the municipalities playing their role with regards to the issue that you have mentioned of the court orders? Because according to my understanding, if there's a court order, the municipality must know about that court order, so that they must look for an alternative place for the person who is being evicted. The person is with the evictee or whatsoever must also be served with that the court order. Yes.
were the municipalities playing their role with regards to that? Because in most cases, when people were evicted, most of the people were just dumped in the street, having no place to stay for that particular period until they get they are being allocated the permanent residence to where they can stay. Then again, what is it? Writing. You mentioned the issue of the conflict as one of the challenges that affects the beneficiaries. According to your research, what were the causes of this conflict? And also maybe if you can make some highlights on the post-settlement support, your findings on the post-settlement support after the people have been allocated land, there are various institutions that are supposed to support the beneficiaries. Are we doing enough on the post-settlement support? And also on the issue of, you mentioned something that after the land has been given to beneficiaries, then the production is being lessened. What is the reason? Because you find that if we buy the land, all the equipment that are in the land, they stay with the beneficiaries. Training is being provided. Then the people, the farm was producing a lot because of those people, because they were working there. They've got skills on farming. Then after the farm has been handed over to them, then that's where the problem starts. According to your research, what are the challenges with regards to that? Thank you, Chair.
Mr. I
did not raise my hand, but I've got a question in mind. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm saying I did not raise up my hand, but I've got one question in mind that I want to pose to Dr. Hall. In your opening, Dr. Hall, you said one of your discoveries is that people should not be shifted from the current land, but rather there should be ways that should be developed that would rather develop the agrarian reform. But my question is that which way would you prescribe to the department or rather to this committee that would speedily you know get the department transferring land from those that has land to the landless, you know, a way that it, that would not subject the department to quite a number of subpoenas to the courts and quite a number of the department losing money to those court orders. Now I'm trying to check because if there isn't any, you know, that the department would employ, that would speedily give land to the landless. I don't know which other way do you have in mind. But I'm actually thinking of, you know, a radical way, a speedy way of transferring land to the landless. Radical not in the sense of that the Zimbabwean model, but rather something that is speed, that would be done with speed, that would transfer the land to the landless. And thank you, Chairperson.
And thank you for the points that you made. I think that yours was a comment. There are advantages for people to work together collectively. There are also sometimes costs and difficulties, especially when people don't have a history of working together. I think that there are different situations where people would like to work together and should be supported to do so. And often this means the need for structures to assist cooperatives to work. We shouldn't assume that
there must also be alternatives to forcing people into large groups. And that has been one of the problems in redistribution specifically. The Honourable Dandala asked about models of success. Interestingly, I would say that the major examples of successful land reforms and agrarian reforms internationally were during the Cold War, in a very different global political context, places like Taiwan and South Korea that were able to implement very far-reaching land reforms that restructured from a feudal landlord system to a much more widespread, more equitable system of land holding, and that is widely recognized as having laid the basis for the economic development in those Southeast Asian countries. I wouldn't say that there are recent examples of successful land reforms, particularly in the post-Cold War era. I think that even on our continent, we have adopted market-based programs in Kenya and in Zimbabwe. In South Africa, although we use different terminology, we've had slightly different ways of implementing them. By and large, we have replicated some of the mistakes that have been seen in Kenya and Zimbabwe. But yes, I think that there are international examples of success. But I do think that the market-based approach that we have adopted has also been very difficult in Colombia, in Brazil, in Namibia. So I don't think that there are simple examples of success, but I think that there are historical examples of this. And it really goes to a question of political leeway and the parameters for a process that directly confronts particular class interests. I mean, far-reaching land reform does do that. So I think that there are some examples. I think that there was a question about caste. There was a major review of caste conducted a few years ago. And what it effectively showed was that of the six different types of support that caste is meant to provide to people, it was really only training. So there hadn't been much emphasis on implements, on infrastructure development, and on the other dimensions of caste. So the thing with caste is it's a comprehensive agricultural support program, but it's been not comprehensive. It's been very patchy, both in terms of who gets access to it, and even those who do, what kinds of support they can get. But I think that with the question of post-settlement support, the question is about access to appropriate support, but also the timing of that, because in many cases, production declines result from the fact that land transfer and provision of support are not aligned. There are different departments with different budgeting and programmatic systems. So to get these to work together has been enormously complex. That has been one problem. Another aspect of post-settlement support that I think is often ignored is institutional post-settlement support. So post-settlement support isn't just for using the land, it's for establishing the institution that can manage the land. And that's why I raised issues about PPAs and so on. With regard to underutilization, all we have are estimates. And these estimates are generally assumed to be very conservative, partly because most underutilization of land happens within a property. So you don't have we do have entire farms that are not used at all. But a lot of land is underused as part of a property where there is some production. So, we don't have a lot of detail. Also, we know that a lot of commercial farms have gone out of production, either through being converted into game farms or into other non-agricultural uses, golf courses. Often elite developments have resulted in commercial farms going out of production. So it's ironic that a lot of the concerns about keeping up production in the context of land reform is happening alongside a lot of farm going out of production, but not as a result of land reform, but as a result of land uses of rich people. There was a question on EFTA. Yeah. Under EFTA, Section 92D notices have to go to the municipality. This is only if a case goes to court, and as I mentioned, the majority of eviction cases don't go to court. But if it goes to court, a Section 90D notice goes to the municipality. And also to the department, to the local office of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. They have obligations that are prescribed in EFTA to respond to those notices.
As far as we could ascertain, many of those officers merely file the notice. So they have a filing system rather than a response system. But so many of the courts are issuing eviction orders without having had a response from either of those institutions. They are meant to come with a Section 93 report that looks at the potential impact on the people concerned if the eviction were to be allowed. Their role is not merely to arrange for alternative accommodation. It's meant to engage with the court and inform the court. But even where an eviction is to be granted, we actually, not in this research, but we did some research looking at municipalities and IDPs and how IDPs are addressing land and agrarian reform. What we found is that most municipalities have no system for prioritizing evictees for alternative accommodation. So they have a normal housing program. And a number of officials said, well, we have emergency or disaster relief provisions, but we're not even sure if an eviction of a household or a whole community constitutes a disaster. So, no, there are incredibly weak and uncertain responses from these institutions. And I would emphasize not only municipalities, but also district and provincial offices of the department in terms of responsiveness to threatened evictions. There were some questions about conflicts. Clearly, when you have a valuable resource and a large and often differentiated community, conflict over resources can result. But I think that there are many reasons for conflict, not all of which are under the control, obviously, of our government officials. It's not that they should be responding to all of them. The reasons for production declines. I think that skills are often blamed for production declines, but I think that one factor that has come up as important in a lot of these impact assessments, the only studies that we have, which are not very extensive, suggests that it's the total absence of operating capital. You get large communities of poor people on commercial farms, and yes, the infrastructure is there, and the expectation in business plans is that people must replicate that form of farming. Well, it's the lack of operating capital, I think, is crucial. And finally, there was a question about what are the alternatives to speed up a process but not to get tied up in court process. I think what we were suggesting, and I hope that chapter 3 of the book deals with this, is that the alternative to willing buyer, willing seller doesn't mean expropriate all the time. It means have a strategic vision, have a process and a method for engaging with landless people around their land needs as part of wider development initiatives. This cannot be done unless you have a highly skilled and resourced institution that actually requires institution building. The current staffing levels and vacancy levels within the department suggest that it doesn't have that capacity to really drive both speeding up and improving the quality of the process at present. I do think that investing in the institution that is responsible for this process is crucial. And what it requires is over time, developing a skilled team that can assist people to identify land that is needed and to develop plans for transfer and for land use. And this requires a multi-skilled team, which would include agricultural officials. We have tended to have different departments working somewhat separately. In some regions, they're working together fairly effectively. But I do think that skilling up the institution is really a precondition for moving forward and for speeding up delivery without replicating the same problems that we've seen today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hall. Honourable members, we have run out of time, but we have prioritized this presentation because it's one of the most important things or tools for this committee to be able to engage in this very complicated matter. There are three things, Dr. Hall, I think is going to be a request of this committee to you. One of them is, I would have posed the question rather, instead of posing a question, I think I should make a proposal. The first proposal it may be important because, you see, this book reveals so many things that many South Africans know about. Perhaps they're looking at different windows. They see just a patch of the total picture that you have summarized into a book. And there are many summits about land. But the people responsible for this work that you're talking about is the department itself. Surely, not everybody is ignorant about this matter. There has to be some coordinated and concerted way to change the policies and the laws such that they take into consideration this matter. Because there are many policies, there are many laws that are creating unintended consequences that are giving rise to this problem. Is there no way that you and your team can meet with the department to deal with this? The reason why I'm raising this question is because in my short period as the chair of this committee, I've met reports and people talking about projects as isolated projects of the department to respond to various loopholes in the land reform and agrarian reform. I'm suggesting that there should be a coordinated way between the department and PLAS to talk about the total picture rather than just projects. And I'm sure the committee would be willing to participate in that, both as a facilitator and a participant in that process. I am not convinced that the officials working in that department are not aware of the issues you are raising. They may not be able to engage with the totality of the picture, but they know the windows, through the windows they're looking at, these problems that you're talking about. That's my first one. My second one, the real reason why it is an echo, Mr. Musi, is because there's a... That's right. The second proposal is the... Surely, not all provinces are as dismal as the picture seems to indicate. There are provinces that are successful in some part of what you're talking about, and maybe weak in some parts of what. Because, for sure, any practitioner in rural development may be strong in organizing and mobilizing people, but it may not be strong in the actual food production. And another one may be strong in food production, but not strong in mobilizing and organizing people. So you need institutions, you need practitioners, you need policy formulators, you need researchers, you need the totality of the players. And the department should have those people. And if they are in line with Bishop here, there are case studies that we can point at in various provinces of this country where their leaders, their projects, their programs, their conducive atmosphere for success, but nobody to bring them together. I want to make a proposal that apart from engaging at a government ministerial level where perhaps all of us may be involved, we should also identify at a provincial level and at an official level so that we can engage with those success stories that may be replicated in similar conditions. I have been told by Matlaba there that there are areas in KwaZulu-Natal where there is no shortage of rain. There is no problem with the vegetation. There is no unwillingness on the part of the people to do the work. And yet, some of the land that has been given over to the people via restitution, lying fallow, no food production. And the animals that were there are roaming around, including ordinary pigs are now warthogs. Now, I'm suggesting that there is a way that we can engage. You see, because we are not a committee of... you remember in the olden days, there used to be a book called Changi Chali. People were asked to find a mistake on the pictures. And this. We are not a committee to do that. We are not a committee of finding mistakes. We are a committee to help the nation progress in rural development and land reform. Our responsibility is to gather as much information as possible, put the players together. We are not the players ourselves, we are the facilitators. The third proposal I want to make. This committee is in a strategic position to collect as much information as possible in line with what you are doing in order to use that information to further engage with the department and effectively do our own oversight in a way that would make us contribute in improving the situation. We continue to stand on mountain tops and say there's a crisis in land reform, but we're not proposing solutions to that problem. Our committee should be providing those solutions. Even if we visit an area, we should be able to come back and say what best methods of solving those problems we've encountered there can we propose to the department. Because we have an opportunity to call an official of the department to come here and engage with that official. And there's no reason why we shouldn't do that. I'm making that proposal not only to you, Dr. Hall, but to us as well. And so that when you leave here, we should sit together and say, what can we do? We've got this information, we've got this book with which to engage, with other reports that may refer to in the book and by other people as well. What can we do as a committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for those comments. And I think that all that I can say in response is to reiterate PLAS's willingness to provide information that we can to support the deliberations of this committee. In the past, we have made presentations to this committee providing analyses of the department's annual report, and also we have tended to provide shadow analyses of the budget every year to assist in your deliberations. I think PLAS remains committed to doing primary research on the ground. We are constantly looking for success stories. Whenever we can, we talk about those. Not just at project level, but often there are wider levels. For instance, Amatole District Municipality is doing different things from many other districts when it comes to land reform because their leadership is much more engaged. There are different examples of success stories. It's not just project level. And I do think that across the country there's a need to support work of that kind. Similarly, we have engaged with the department directly. The department was part of this process, attended our conference, engaged. The Director General, the current Director General in particular, was engaged. We also do not want to be in the business of always finding fault, and we are trying all the time to be constructive and to be part of trying to find solutions. My own view is that solutions to the problems identified here don't lie with this department alone. And so really the question is what kind of interministerial process can be brought about to assist. And also perhaps engagements with your counterparts. So we are ready to bring information that we have when requested. We are ready to talk about partnerships around future research where there are needs. And beyond that, we will continue with our function of doing independent research and sharing information. But we would be open to, if there are specific ideas and suggestions, to engaging further. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you to the members.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hall. This is the time to move on to another item. We prioritized you, Dr. Hall, and PLAS because we thought that your input was going to enhance our ability to deliberate on the matters. Thank you very much. And thanks again for the books. Visitors left before we could even announce them. They were late and they left. Unfortunately, you have not become aware who they are and why they were here. There's nothing we can do about it because I was warned they were coming, but before we could introduce them, they left. Sorry. Mthakazi, uzawukabana nam and kanungu kabana msinyana. And it is to tell them about the Ungabakapa, Wambena, Tedanganga, Guna, Guava Pants, Kubango Bam, Galavan, no by gatekeeper Google.